24 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 265, Mormon Intellectualism, Community or Movement, a paper presented by Ryan Cragen.
Entitled Mormon Intellectualism, Community or Movement. And it is my job as chair. My name is Becky Johns, and I am very excited to be here and to listen to this particular presentation. I've been anticipating it for several days now. And I would like for you to be reminded that sessions today are by name tag or ticket only. And so if you didn't have a ticket or a name tag, then you're illegal. I don't know what we're going to do about that, but since I'm not going to kick you out. Please remember that if you have cell phones or pagers or any other kind of noisemakers, turn those off, please, so to give our speaker the respect that he deserves for this particular session. We're very delighted to have Ryan Cragen speaking on this topic today. And Ryan has a master's degree in sociology and currently is a PhD student at the University of Cincinnati. He also serves as editor for the Mormon Social Science Association newsletter and is an editorial assistant for the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion. Ryan has a particular interest in Mormonism and, as you can tell from his activities, sociological studies in Mormonism. And you'll see that his topic today is an attempt to define and classify or provide a definition for what we're doing here at Sunstone, or at least what some people are doing at Sunstone. So I'm going to turn the time over to Ryan. He will speak for about 30 minutes, at which point we will entertain questions from the audience. So if you have questions, please be prepared to come up to the microphone or to speak very loudly so that we can get it on the tape. And I'll turn the time over now to Ryan.
A couple things before I start. First, this presentation is made up actually of three papers that I have written over time, and you'll kind of see components. So if it jumps around a little bit, please bear with me. You'll kind of see where the papers intersect a little bit. Also, one thing you'll notice is that I'm not really going to give answers here. I don't claim to be an expert on this per se, and I don't think there is a good answer to where I'm going with this presentation. What I hope to do is explore these issues to kind of clarify the territory, and then we'll see. And I'm actually going to end the presentation with three questions, and hopefully you can offer some answers for me too. Okay. Anyway, basically there are three components to this presentation. The first is the question, who are the intellectuals? It seems as though this term is kind of bandied around, not only within the intellectual communities that we'll talk about, but also within the LDS Church, right? That this term gets thrown around, and it's not always clear to whom it is referring. So the first question that I'm going to try to address is, who are the intellectuals within Mormonism? The second question is then taking that a step further and asking, okay, well, if we can define who these intellectuals are they organized into a community or a movement or something in between or neither? Can we see some sense of organization to this group that is often referred to as intellectuals? And the last question is, does it really matter if they are a community or a movement? And we'll get into, say, church responses to this group when we examine that question. So we'll begin with the first one, defining intellectual. And what I found in the reading that I've done, some of the research that I've done, is that there are really two definitions of intellectual. Okay. The first definition is more of a formal definition, and I'm stemming from two sources, really. The first is from Thomas O'Day, not his classic work on the Mormons, but another work looking at intellectual Catholics, right? And basically his definition is, you know, those men and women whose main interest is the advancement of knowledge, right? They're interested in cultural, social issues, and they're trying to address those. That would include a lot of people, right? Even within the Mormon Church, that would include a lot of people. If you push a little bit further, I am also drawing on Richard Hofstadter and his, I guess, classic study of anti-intellectualism in American life, and he also has a definition. It's a little bit more discriminating than O'Day's, and for that reason, I think I'm going to stick to that one with the formal definition, but basically he's talking about people that engage in the life of the mind, right? People that are very much interested in examining these issues intellectually, right? From the life of the mind. But he includes two kind of additional characteristics that I found really quite interesting when it comes to intellectuals. He includes this idea of intellectual piety and intellectual playfulness. And what he means, and this is very simplified considering his book is 400 pages long, is intellectual piety, he's referring to kind of a respect for intellectuality, for academic engagement, right? They respect it. They're pious. They're humble about it. They really respect the practice that they have. The playfulness component really boils down, I mean, he includes some practical joke type stuff, but what it really boils down to is intellectual curiosity, okay? So not only do they respect the life of the mind, but they're also curious. And they're not just curious about, say, their particular area of expertise, but they're curious about virtually everything. They're very curious individuals that are constantly wanting to know more. Okay, so these are two kind of classic definitions of this idea of intellectual, and then you obviously have to ask the question, okay, if we're looking just at Mormonism, the mainstream LDS church, who would this include? And in a classic tradition of Good Relief Society presentations, I've got visual aids. Okay, basically, I'm illustrating the main church body as kind of an arrow, right, with the direction of the church headed in a specific way, and that arrow is including the leadership of the church, okay, which some might argue could be considered intellectuals, considering these people are engaged in some degree, the life of the mind. Well, if we're going to examine this, then we can begin to look at different groups that could potentially be considered intellectuals using this formal definition, right? So first we have our liberals. Right, our liberal intellectuals look around, the Sunstoners, the dialogue, people that contribute to these different groups. You also have your feminists, who could be considered intellectuals. The lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual community could also be considered intellectuals. Okay, the apologists could be considered intellectuals using this definition. Your Orthodox scholars, contributors to farms, could be considered intellectuals. The church educational system, perhaps, could be considered intellectuals. Again, we'll talk a little bit more about this. The church research division could potentially be considered intellectuals. And finally, just kind of our general scholars, those that don't necessarily engage at a religion level, but they could be chemists and others that also consider these ideas but maybe don't publish. Okay, and you'll notice, obviously, that I depicted this as though these different groups are exerting some form of pressure on the main church body, right? They have an influence. They're all depicted as arrows, as though they're doing some sort of pressurizing on the main church body. So that's the formal definition, okay? But ironically, I don't think the formal definition is the most common definition used for intellectual in Mormonism. The second definition I've referred to as a colloquial definition, right? And this is stemming not only from just kind of the way that it seems to be commonly used in common Mormon discourse, but also some additional criteria that Hofstadter used in his analysis of anti-intellectualism by narrowing this group down. Because if we include everybody, I mean, we're talking about a lot of people. So Hofstadter, and I have a few quotes here. First of all, he looks at the origin of the term intellectual, which I found quite interesting, right? First came into use in France, and I don't know a whole lot about the Dreyfus case, but basically he makes a really interesting point. He says, at that time, the term came to be used by both sides, right? By the right as a kind of insult towards the intellectuals, and by the Dreyfusard intellectuals as a proud banner. Let us use this word, wrote one of them in 1888, since it has received high consecration. And it seems to me that among the, say, liberal intellectuals within the LDS religion, that it has also become kind of a badge of honor, right? That not only is it used kind of derogatorily to say, oh, well, you know, you're an intellectual, but it's also used now to say, well, I am an intellectual, right? There are two sides, and it's being bantied about like that. The next component that Hofstadter includes here is that if intellectuals become absorbed into an accredited institution, then in a certain sense they cease to be intellectuals, right? So if the intellectuals are just kind of spouting the party line and they aren't really exploring outside of that, then they're really no different than the main leadership, right? And if we look specifically at the Mormon religion, then church educational system kind of seems to be sucked into the main church body, and in that sense they cease to be intellectuals outside of that. You could also include perhaps your Orthodox scholars, the church research division, that if you use this more discriminating definition of intellectual, it's a more colloquial definition, then they cease to be intellectuals in the sense that they've been co-opted, right? If they've been co-opted, then they're really not standing out. Why make a distinction? Additionally, Hofstadter claims that the modern idea of the intellectuals includes a sense of protest, right? That there's something about these intellectuals that means they're standing up for a moral position, a political position. So if you're not really protesting anything, then Hofstadter's going to exclude you from the realm of the intellectuals. Okay? And again, I mean, like I said, this is an exploration. I'm not trying to define this, you know, end of story. So if you don't agree with this, at the end we can talk about this. Give me some comments and feedback. To continue, there's a little bit more here. Finally, this is the last quote from Hofstadter. He basically says that if there is any real intellectual establishment in America, and he was writing this in the 1960s, it's on the left of center. Okay, it's not a right of center group. And you could potentially argue that, you know, the apologists perhaps are on the right of center, so we could begin to exclude them as another group. Thus, in my terms, kind of simplifying what we've gone through here, basically, among Mormons, in a colloquial sense, intellectuals come to refer to the liberals, the heretics, the apostates, and specifically the alternate voices that were referenced in Dallin H. Oak's famous General Conference talk in 1989, right? The people that are outside the mainstream. So, and additionally, it's used to self-identify, right? I don't know how many of you here would consider yourselves an intellectual, right? But I think it's an interesting point. So if we go to the colloquial definition as opposed to the formal definition, who would this include? Well, we go back to the visual aid and we start taking groups away. It's not going to include our apologists. It's not going to include the Orthodox researchers or members of the church educational system, church research division, or just kind of your general scholars. It has to be the people who are protesting, okay, have some sort of stance outside the mainstream, and are also somewhat left of the center, okay? These are just the two definitions that I've seen. And again, this isn't necessarily a clear distinction. Some people can fall somewhere along this continuum. In fact, Darrell and Kendall White wrote a paper where they looked at this distinction as a continuum, right? Where you can go anywhere from kind of the apostate to the apologist and anywhere in between. And I don't want to give the sense that this is kind of a clear-cut distinction between these two. I think there's a lot of overlap and interchange between these two definitions. But I do think it's kind of interesting that it's used both ways, right? In fact, there was a recent article, I think it was by Mary Beth Raines in FAIR, where she was essentially arguing that the liberals had co-opted the definition or the term intellectual, and she didn't like that. She wanted to be included within that group, right? She considered herself an intellectual too, and she didn't think it was fair for just the liberals to have that title. Okay, so it seems to be going both ways. Well, again, I think this is a really interesting continuum. I'd love to get your feedback, see what you think about this issue. But the reason why I address this is, well, before I can start arguing for a community or a movement, I need to know who I'm talking about, right? And you'll see that I do limit who I'm discussing when I begin to examine communities and movements. Okay, so which definition is the preferred definition? Well, I think the colloquial the colloquial definition is used more often. Whether that's the more accurate, I don't know. Okay, but I think it's used more often, and I, like I put in the second part of this question, I think it can vary depending on what you're trying to examine. Okay, if you're trying to examine intellectuals in general, you could include them all. Moving to this, the next component, right? So we've examined this idea of intellectual, we'll get some feedback on that. The next component here is, should these intellectual groups be examined as communities or movements? Okay, and the real big impetus for this presentation was actually a lengthy paper I wrote examining these groups as movements, essentially. It was pointed out to me by some anonymous reviewers that I needed to spend more time making this distinction, so I will do that here. Basically, okay, we're going to move into this. There is an argument that, and you'll note here, I need to make this important point, I'm limiting kind of the rest of this part of the presentation to just the second definition, right, the more colloquial definition. So we're going to exclude the Orthodox scholars, the apologists, okay? We're just going to use the kind of liberal intellectuals. This would possibly include the feminists and the homosexual community, but I don't spend as much time on those. It's primarily liberal intellectuals that I'm discussing here. But there definitely is an argument that can be made for this being a community, right? For instance, you know, you examine Genesis. It is a church-sponsored group. Well, the Sunstone Symposium, the Sunstone community, other members of that community, they're not necessarily oppositional, right? They don't happen to be church-sponsored, but they're not really oppositional to the church. They're really a forum for discussion, okay? Very similar, at least for some people, to Genesis, okay? And other potential groups like that. There's no real kind of conscientious effort to form themselves into a movement or to reform the church, at least most of the time, okay? So, again, you can argue that this is just a community. It's not necessarily a movement. And then we look at the recent survey by Stevens and Curtis, reported in Sunstone, talking about this sense of community. And if you look at some of the results of this survey, okay, you find that a lot of people do feel like there is a sense of community within Sunstone. Not everybody, but a lot of people do feel like there's some sense of camaraderie, support within the community, the Sunstone community. Okay, so I think there can be a very clear argument made that this is really just a community, and we can leave it at that. But if we move to the next one, right, the Mormon intellectual movement, and we argue for a movement, let's examine some of the positions that we could take and some of the evidence as to why this might be a movement. Basically, if you look at the organizational mission statements, what you see is they declare an intent of honest inquiry, open dialogue. Okay. Well, the question I would ask you is, why is this included in the mission statements if this is already a component of the mainstream church? If it already exists in the church, then there's really no need for these communities. Okay? I see these framings of their mission statements as pushing towards a movement definition. Okay? They're pushing for something that does not exist within the mainstream church. They're pushing for honest inquiry and open dialogue, and it doesn't exist. And in a sense, they're inherently critical. Okay, they're saying, well, this needs to exist, and we want this to exist. Whether they want that for the entire religion, some would argue yes, some would argue no, but it's definitely a component of these groups. Okay, they also occasionally publish work that is critical of the church. Okay, and I don't know that anybody would necessarily argue with that. I mean, it's critical of some of the beliefs, some of the practices, but it definitely explores these issues from a critical perspective. In that sense, again, it is a movement within the religion, some or without, but within the religion to perhaps change, at least criticize, right? Perhaps actuate change. So, and again, this is where we kind of jump to one of my additional papers. This was a paper that I examined, essentially looking at the roots or the origins of the Mormon intellectual movement is the way I framed it. But basically, if we do argue that this is a movement, can we see how it has similarities to other social movements? So what I did is I took a social movement's framework. It's called the Political Processes Framework. And I examined the Mormon intellectual movement, specifically the liberalish intellectual movement, from that perspective and examined, can we see the origins of this movement? Can we see how it potentially began? And can we see all of the components of classic social movements, right? Well, using this model basically has three elements, right? The first is that you've got to have organizational resources. You can't have a movement without the resources, right? You have to have organizations, you have to have people, you have to have communities, you have to have money, you have to have funds to put stuff together, to send out your information. Well, what you have, and I'm going to gloss over this because this isn't really the gist of what I'm going at today, but starting just after 1950, early 1960s, you begin to see a lot of this stuff formalize, right? You have the founding of the Mormon History Association in the mid-1960s. You have the founding of Dialogue during that same time period. The scholarly communities began to develop just before then with the Swearing Elders at the University of Utah. You also have Leonard Arrington and Bitton Campbell. They're all meeting together, starting to discuss these things in part through the kind of communal history associations that they belong to, and thus you have the development of these organizations, right? These movement organizations. You develop organizational resources. But also, I mean, and this is an additional component of social movements, they generally do not form unless there's a reason for them to form. They have to feel like there's some sense of injustice, right? If everything's fine and dandy, then why would you want to change it? So what I argue here is basically that there was an insurgent consciousness that developed during the same time period surrounding several very specific issues. One, probably the most famous, is blacks in the priesthood. A lot of members of this intellectual community had problems with the church's stance on blacks in the priesthood and full participation in the church. There was also a growing conservatism among the church leadership, especially with the influence of Ezra Taft Benson throughout the 60s, 70s, almost up to the 80s, kind of toned himself down at that point, or was forced to, I don't really know which. There was also an increasing objectivity in the scholarship. A lot of Mormons were being educated outside of Utah, even within Utah, and finding kind of new means of doing research. This is often referred to as new Mormon history, right? That they begin to approach history not so much from a faith-promoting perspective, but kind of from an objective perspective, saying, well, have we included everything, right? I mean, we kind of left a few things out, and so you get a more objective scholarship. You also get some closed archives right around this time, even though there was a window, the Camelot years, supposedly, when the archives were more open. Okay, but as Arrington talks about actually in his autobiography, he attributes one of the kind of stimuli for the development of this group was the fact that they wanted to get together to kind of pressure the church to open the archives, in part so they could respond to anti-Mormon criticisms of the church. Okay, and if you don't have all the information you need and that information is kind of being withheld from the institution you're trying to defend, it can be a little bothersome, right? So you have an insurgent consciousness developing around these ideas. And finally, you also have political opportunities, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense to attack a well-fortified opponent. If the church was in a perfect position and your development of a movement was going to effectuate no change, then why would you bother? In the social movement literature, what you often find is a type of mothering organization, right? One movement will spawn a second movement. And this is a great example, specifically in this case, that you look at the successes of the civil rights movement and how that failed to kind of infiltrate the LDS church in terms of their position on blacks and the priesthood. So what you have is all of these successes of social movements moving up through the 60s and even the 70s with the feminist movement, and what they do is begin to spawn additional movements. The LDS church came under a lot of criticism during the 1960s because of its stance on blacks and the priesthood. Well, because they were being opened up to criticism, it also forms opportunities for new social movements to develop, like the Mormon intellectual movement from the liberal side. You also had a kind of a sense of divided elites. Not everybody shared Ezra Taft Benson's political views. Right. So you have divided elites, and you then have opportunities for them to influence the leadership of the church. Okay. So basically, examining the Mormon intellectual movement, as I've dubbed it, from a political processes model, you can see that it has all of the elements of a classic social movement, right? There's organizational resources, there's an injustice frame, there's an insurgent consciousness, and there are political opportunities, all kind of converging during a very specific period in time, and thus you have the origins, like I said, during the 1960s of the Mormon intellectual movement. Okay. Again, and I don't want this to turn into kind of a, oh, this is a movement type presentation where I'm trying to convince you that it is a movement. You can choose to take that or leave that. But one final kind of push on this tone is basically the idea that if it's not a movement, then you really shouldn't have any counter-movement activity, right? If it's not a movement, then they're just going to ignore it. It's not a big deal. But what, in fact, you do have by the church leadership is some counter-movement activity, right? You have some excommunications taking place among the members of this group. You have statements, very specific statements, about participation in symposia. Okay? Church leadership saying, don't get involved. You have the establishment of farms, fair, all taking place during this time period, and supposedly to kind of counteract what's going on within the liberal intellectual movement. You have a reinvigoration of BYU studies, according to Leonard Arrington, all taking place during the same time. And finally, you have restrictions on movement members' ability to publish in church-sanctioned education publications, like Deseret Book, Bookcraft, and The Ensign. So you have all of these examples of counter-movement activity, right? And what I'm trying to illustrate is, again, that you can see this and frame this as a type of social movement, right? So we kind of end with this question here, is this really a community or is this a movement? And there are kind of two ways to frame this question. Is it a community or a movement? And do you want it to be a community or a movement? Which leads me to my final question that I had hoped to address with this presentation, right? Basically, it depends on the individual and the perspective. There are really ample evidence for both. I think a lot of people approach the Sunstone community as a community, looking for support, people to talk to about their views, their questions that they have, but I think you also have individuals that are hoping that this can actually have an effect, right? That you can help other people see, oh, well, maybe there are other ways of looking at things, right? But what we get to is the implications of if it is a movement, right? Well, what if this is a movement? How is the institutional church going to respond? Are they going to respond? Okay. Well, as I noted earlier, I mean, we have the counter-movement activity, but if this is a movement, then you have the potential for excommunications. And this is all given kind of the assumption of a relatively authoritarian hierarchy that does not accept necessarily outside influences, right? They don't want a movement within the religion. That kind of brings into question their authority. So they're going to have to respond. They're going to limit your publication outlets. They're going to discourage participation, all of the examples, and finally you're going to get the negative label, going back to the second definition of the term intellectual, the colloquial definition. Not only is it seen as a badge of honor by the intellectuals, but it's also used as a negative label. Kind of using a personal anecdote, before I actually even subscribed to Sunstone or Dialogue, I was often referred to within the congregations that I attended as an intellectual. And I think the connotation was that that was a negative thing. I asked too many questions, right? I was a whore in gospel doctrine classes because I asked questions. And I had several instructors actually say, well, you know, that's just intellectualizing religion. I didn't see the problem with that, personally, okay? But it does seem to come with kind of this negative label. Actually, I have one more point here. But what I really want to kind of get at, and well, we'll get to it here. We'll go through the questions. So basically, I'm ending here, right? I'm going to ask these questions and let you respond to these questions. I think I've ended a little bit early. Yeah, that's about right. So these are three questions that I'm going to throw out to members of the audience, see what you have to say about it. But the last question here, which I think is really kind of an interesting question, is whether or not it matters. Okay. Does it really matter if we choose to consider, say, the Sunstone community as a community or a movement, if the response by the institutional church has already been that it is a movement? Right. They've responded with counter-movement activity. So you can call it a movement, a community, all you want, but if the church is already responding as though it's a movement, does this become a moot question? Okay. Basically, that's it. I listed my references up there, but I'll go back to the questions so everybody can see them, and if you'd like to come up and respond, have questions, have comments, I'd be happy to hear them, and thanks for your time.
Intelligentsia the same as intellectuals, or any different definitions?
Okay, come on, do you want me to repeat it for you? Do you consider intelligentsia the same as intellectual?
Good question. I think the formal definition would include that. But that, I mean, that's my take on it. The colloquial of intellectual, right? That it's that broad that it would include kind of all intelligentsia. Though, if you examine the way that Richard Hofstadter approaches this, he probably wouldn't. Okay, he's very discriminating about the group of individuals that he includes as intellectuals. The reason being, he wants people that aren't just kind of highly educated, right? That just do rote stuff. So you have, say, a bureaucrat that happens to have a PhD but just crunches numbers for the government all day. He would not consider that individual an intellectual, even though intelligentsia would include that individual, right? His definition of an intellectual would say no. He has to have that component of not only intellectual piety but intellectual playfulness. He has to be curious about everything, right? So you can't just be highly educated and be a member of the intelligentsia or an intellectual according to Hofstadter. You have to take it a step further and actually question, right? And question a lot and include those other components like the protest and stuff like that. Does that answer the question? Okay.
All right. Another question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to raise just a question about that you don't deal with, but I think is implicit in the whole presentation, and that is context. And rather than go to Hofstadter, let me refer to Anthony Wallace, an anthropologist, who dealt very actively with revitalizing cultures. Wallace struggled with the issue of what is the role of the intellectual in a conservative community culture, in a revitalizing culture, and in a reactionary culture. And it seems to me, and I'd be curious whether you would define the present church as a reactionary institution or a conservative institution, because the role of the intellectual changes in any of those contexts. At the very early stages of the church, for example, I would say that was a vitalizing period, and the role of the intellect was terribly crucial and invited, and it wasn't that they were spouting the party line, they were actually defining what the church was going to be and how the church was going to address certain issues that came. So the role of the intellectual in the early period of the church was really different than it is now. And so I'd be really curious, first of all, are we a reactionary period or a conservative period, and what is the role of the intellectual within that context?
That's a great question. I'm not personally familiar with Wallace's work, so I don't know that I can give a great explanation, but I think if you look at, say, Armin Moss's kind of idea of retrenchment, it's almost a mixture of those two, right? That you've got kind of a reactionary period, in part because of this kind of liberal intellectualist movement type activity, right? That they're retrenching, that they're moving more towards kind of a fundamentalist kind of perspective as a reactionary approach, but it's also movement towards a conservative end of the spectrum. That would be my perspective. I think earlier on, you're right, the role of the intellectual has changed quite dramatically over time, especially in the early church, and in the lengthier paper, I begin to examine the roots, kind of the origins of this Mormon intellectual movement stemming from just after the turn of the century. Starting in the 1900s, early 1900s, you begin to have an increase, say, in the number of publications by Mormons, Mormon intellectuals, Mormon academics, examining Mormonism, both in the social sciences and in history, and that moves up all the way up until about the 1950s when you get publications like Fawn Brody's, you know, No Man Knows My History, where you begin to get these really classic publications. There were a few before the 1950s, but that's also the date that I believe Bitton attributes to the beginning of the new Mormon history era, right, is 1950. That's the beginning of kind of a formalization period. But I think you're right, that you're seeing kind of a change in the organization, that initially it was kind of this, you know, vital organization that needed the intellectuals, and now it's kind of like, well, we don't really want them. So... other questions? Come on.
I just got a couple quick questions. One, you mentioned that the claim that the liberal left side are taking the term intellectual as their own. Would you consider that, do they do that, or would you consider that being done as to imply that the left is intellectual, and so anyone who is not in the left is unintellectual or unintelligent? And also, You mentioned apologetics. Today, a lot of Mormon apologetics, a lot of people within the church will consider that outside of doctrine, consider it rewriting. I mean, there's that article by Duffy a couple months ago who said that it's rewriting the faith. Would, since it's from many inside the church, if it's seen as being outside, rewriting the faith, would that be considered liberal, intellectual?
That's a great question. I don't know that I would consider the apologists liberal intellectuals. If anything, they're probably closer to kind of the Orthodox scholars, right? That would be my approach. And I think Duffy takes the same approach in that article, where he's drawing a very fine distinction between the two. Interestingly, in Ash's presentation today, it was in one of the panels, he used the terms interchangeably. Now, I actually wanted to question him on that, because I don't know that they should be used interchangeably. Apologist and Orthodox scholar seem to be a little bit different to me. But I think that, I mean, that's a good point. Should we include the apologists who aren't necessarily within the mainstream body of the church as intellectuals? Using the first definition, they obviously are, right? And then a second component to that, and this was actually another one of the criticisms that I received by these anonymous reviewers, is that this same type of kind of social movement analysis should be done for apologists. You can look at the origins of, say, the apologetics movement within the Mormon Church the same way that I'm doing it with the liberal intellectuals within the Mormon Church. Some could argue that it's a movement, and that's why I depicted all of these groups as arrows, right, in my visual aid, that they all are trying to exert an influence on the direction of the Church. I think it was that recent comic, it was in the same issue of Sunstone, where all of the general authorities are getting on the bus and the driver's wearing a Farms t-shirt, right? I mean, basically that's the idea, is that, you know, they're now beginning to kind of show their influence, and the church seems to be going along with the Orthodox scholars, as opposed to, say, the intellectuals, the liberal intellectuals. So, yeah.
It may not be what your issue is or what you're planning on defending, but how would you analyze what is happening with the movement now? And where do you think it's going? Is it becoming more vital? Or is it stagnating? Or
got some of the leaders in here. I'll repeat it. What do I think is happening with the movement? Interesting. I mean, that's a tough question, actually. If you look at, say, what Paul Toscano said, I think it was last year, in the meetings here, he actually is very critical of Sunstone and the approach that Sunstone's taking, because he sees it as not being as kind of liberal as it has been, perhaps, in past years, can be. And he actually, I think one of the, you know, very specific statements he made was that, you know, you're kind of crazy to think that you're going to get an unofficial church sanctioning to go ahead and do what you're doing. That's never really been the intent of Sunstone, right? I think I kind of agree to some extent that if Sunstone and dialogue, right? Try to kind of moderate what they're doing to increase the participation of, say, Orthodox scholars or even apologists in what they're doing, then it's going to lose some of its flavor. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? I don't know. Again, there are a lot of issues here. People can choose to call it a community. People can choose to call it a movement. In fact, Gary Bergera said that it's almost some stone heresy to consider this a type of movement. They're not trying to change the church. They're not posting some 95 theses outside the Mormon church, Mormon tabernacle, saying we need to change all this stuff. But I think that's a great question, right? And I think that Sunstone, the community itself, has kind of hit a point where it needs to make a decision of where to go. Does it want to kind of embrace more of a moderate position and invite some of the more apologetic authors and Orthodox scholars in? Or does it want to maintain kind of a liberal perspective? I think it's really at a kind of a critical position. Again, I'm not an expert on this. I'm relatively young, so those that have lived through this could probably comment better on that.
Well, I had something to say, and then I'll add it. It'll address what you were just talking about. As somebody who has a playful interest in more knowledge, I liked that. I like to learn. I never considered myself as smart enough to be an intellectual. Some people might have done so. And out in California, in the just general world I live in, an intellectual was the first definition, the broad definition of somebody who just wants to know more and out on the and trying to do something, but not necessarily really proactive for some great change. And coming to Sunstone, I come as a community. I don't come to support any great movement, to make any great change in some great thing, particularly the three ones you're referring to, the liberals, the feminists, and the alternative lifestyles movements. And I don't like to see me possibly being one of the ones down below being excommunicated from the term intellectuals. And I know definitions sometimes are bandied around different things. I feel a little bit like I think maybe a traditional Muslim would feel, who always believed in the traditional Muslim teachings, and now all these intellectual terrorists have hijacked my religion and my name and my... I wouldn't feel real comfortable about that, and I know that many of those don't feel comfortable about that, although some of them have been gone along with the hijacking in that great movement. I know that I would, if I felt that Sunstone was a movement of change for some of these others, that I'm coming here to support that, well, I wouldn't be coming, because I'm coming for information and understanding and not to support a movement to which I don't necessarily have a particular interest to support.
Let me just try to ask a question that might... Of you, though.
Me. Oh, thanks.
if we take Ryan's perspective here, and his argument is that there wouldn't be a Sunstone, there wouldn't be a community unless there were a lack. In other words, you come as a communicant in order to participate in this understanding, in this dialogue, because it doesn't take place somewhere else. Is that because there's a lack in the organization of the church so that it doesn't take place there? Is that a change then that you would allow yourself to be a part of? If it was the sense that more dialogue was something that we could change about the LDS Church, would you change that aspect of it?
Well, thank you. Interesting question. Well, I am in California, in which it is a fairly liberal state, but the church is not much more liberal there than here. In Utah, I don't believe. There are not a lot of opportunities for someone who has an interest in some of the more esoteric aspects of the gospel of Jesus Christ to get some interesting information and some answers. And I find that in this environment Sunstone is presented, I have an opportunity to hear things and have exposure to ideas that I just don't have within my limited framework and within the local churches that I work and deal. And I think that's the nature of the church. I'm not trying to imply, however, that I want the church to change and suddenly offer all these kind of opportunities with all these individual words, because the difficulty really begins to surpass the reality of the situation. We've got some very specific problems the church has to deal with, and my particular areas of interest they seem to be pale in comparison to some severe problems and large problems the church has to deal with on a realistic basis living in this world. But so I come here because this is where I can go to get something without being forced into being a
Well, a couple of comments and maybe a couple of questions. Luther tacked up his 95 theses not to foment change. They were discussion items for debate among scholars. They were propositions for debate. It was the debate topic for the year. Only had 95 of them. Okay. So they ended up changing, but that wasn't his intent. That's a crucial difference. Now, I'll save my question to last. So it seems to me that if there's going to be change, the questions have to be asked, and they're not getting asked in the mainstream church. No one even occurs, and so that's why the response is, when you ask the question, you ask too many questions, because why would you even ask that? Because they're not even thinking about the problem or the topic, or it doesn't occur to them to ask a question, and so when you bring it up, it's foreign to them. But it has to be asked sometime, because modernity is encroaching, and scientific discoveries are encroaching and challenging some of the basic assumptions that the restoration has had all along. So the questions need to be asked. And if that brings about change, well, so be it. But it's not to foment change, it's simply to get an answer. Or maybe just to ask the question. Maybe there isn't an answer. That's the other thing that I find, as an intellectual, I find great stimulation just asking the question. I'm getting ideas, and I may never get an answer, but I don't care if I get an answer. Maybe there isn't one, or maybe not yet. But asking the question is very satisfying. Now, the question is, must it be one or the other, intellectual, movement or community? Can it be both? And what does that mean?
I think that's right on. I'm not trying to say that it has to be a movement or that it has to be a community. I mean, that's the gist of what I'm saying up there, right? I think people approach it differently. We have one individual that comes as a community. He's trying to find support for the questions that he likes to ask, right? For the things that he wants to know. Whereas, again, I do think some people approach it from a more critical perspective, right? And you know, I hate to kind of harp on this point, but I think inherently in asking the question, there is kind of this idea that you are pushing change, right? Just by asking the question, you're kind of forcing that on to the agenda. And if you do that, you're going to invite change. It's inherently critical, right? So even if you don't necessarily want to consider it a movement, even if you do consider it a community, right, that asks questions, and that's not allowed within the broader community, then you are kind of acting as a movement. Does that make sense? Okay, we had another question.
You just dealt with the question that I had, but I had a second one. In the case of the RLDS, the situation is reversed, where in the recent history, whole church is the movement, and it's the people that are left behind. I don't know if you'd call them the intellectuals. They certainly would be the community that are remaining in place. So does your model still work when you reverse the roles like that?
That's a good point. forgetting now, but I think, again, it was Daryl and Kendall White that examined, I think it was a homosexual movement within the community of Christ Church, and they were using a very similar framework for that specific instance, right? That there is a movement that is very much a movement. They don't kind of bandy around this idea of, are we a community or movement? They were trying to get acceptance within the community of Christ, right? And they worked for a very specific time. They formalized, they organized, and they had newsletters, etc. In that case, you know, where you have the change and the bulk of the church is going along with it and somebody's resisting, I don't know. You know, that's a good point. Does this still work if the bulk of the church wants to go one way and you have a small group that's trying to stop it? I think potentially you could argue that way, that in a sense it does work. And it's really kind of interesting that you could take that a step further and also look at some of the schismatic groups from, say, the mainstream LDS church, right? There are some individuals that decided to go against it. Right, they didn't want the practice of polygamy to stop. So what did they do? They tried to stop it. They tried to stop that change. And when it continued past them, they broke off. Right, the movements exist. The movements have always existed. I mean, from the very inception of the LDS Church, there have been schismatic groups that have disagreed with things that have happened and have tried to voice their opinion. Is that happening right now in the RLDS Church? I personally am not familiar enough to know all of the details of that. So I don't know that I can really give a great answer. Maybe we can talk a little bit more after. But I think they're constantly taking place. There are a lot of movements in all of these groups. So does that kind of address your question? Maybe we can talk a little more.
I want to ask another question, but you
sure.
Summarize.
I'll summarize.
To what degree was Jesus, or was he not, an intellectual?
Ooh, great question. Question is, to what degree was Jesus, or was he not, an intellectual? How to approach that question? Well, I guess we can look at, you know, our criteria for what we've questioned here, well, the definitions that we've proposed, right? Under the formal definition, even though, you know, he didn't supposedly have, say, the education component of this, he was definitely concerned, using O'Day's definition, with social and cultural issues, right? So assuming kind of the historic figure of Jesus existed, he could very easily be categorized as an intellectual using the formal definition. And even using kind of the informal definition, you might categorize that in the sense that he was kind of pushing towards change. Right, he was protesting. He had a very specific moral or political stance. And obviously you can argue that he spurred a movement, right? They don't necessarily have to, but he definitely did. So.
And it cost him.
And it did cost him. There was counter-movement activity in the extreme form. Other questions? Are we going to end early? Oh, Dan, sure.
Been working on three of them, but I'll just not sure which one to start with. That's the problem. Yeah. Seems like when you start anything, you're inherently critiquing the status quo. Our town needs a business. Am I starting a movement or not? So there's always that sort of issue that one doesn't really persuade me to push. Obviously, is the, you know, it's weird to think that I'm a leader of a movement when I really want to be a pastor of a community, you know. And so I want this to be a community, and I certainly don't want counter movements have already begun to do. And so the other thing I'm thought of, and I want to compare myself, our sense going to either of these things, but it seems to me that the monastic tradition within Catholicism, the Jesuit tradition, and things like that, maybe there's a model there, because obviously at first those groups said something's lacking. I'm drawn to this kind of life, or I'm drawn to this sort of approach to, you know, scholastic inquiry or whatever. And they got the brief at first, but now you wouldn't say that there's a Jesuit movement or a contemplative movement or anything like that. And I'm just wondering, in your study of social movements and theories, are there models that would show that at one point a movement becomes a community and we live all happily ever after, sort of
sure.
Thing without the grief? Are there other examples besides maybe the two that I just winged?
Well, no,
the one that I'm specifically thinking of, and it's actually a really interesting paper. I've only just read part of it, but it was recently published in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion by two pretty well-known authors. Basically, what they argue is part of the success of the Catholic Church can be attributed to the fact that they institutionalized their intellectuals, right? Instead of pushing them out, not wanting anything to do with them, and actually kind of punishing them, they brought them in and said, well, okay, you know, just do your thing over there, but we're going to kind of keep a rein on you, and maybe you'll have some influence, but they institutionalized them instead of kicking them out. I don't know that I can come up with any others right off the top of my head, but I think that's a really good example, and that's actually something that I may consider doing with the future paper on this, is saying, well, you know, is this what influence is this going to have on the mainstream LDS church that they kind of ostracize their intellectuals? Because they don't seem to want to bring them into the fold. So, I mean, that's a great point. Yeah?
Just a comment about Sunstorm. I think it plays a tremendous community role. When I think of the people who were excommunicated, who no longer have a formal voice, if you will, but they find a community, and that's really crucial. Whether they're right. having an impact, continuing impact is irrelevant. They have a wonderful community, and I hope Sunstone never deviates from that sort of nesting role for people who have been extricated and removed from the formal organization.
That's a great point. Should I repeat that for the tape? Basically saying that he really values the role that Sunstone plays, because some people do get kicked out of kind of the broader LDS church, but then they do have the resource of Sunstone as a community to kind of support them. Other questions? Comments?
I'd rather have you do it if you have.
The one that got me was your little the thing there at the end, you know, where the critical time, someone has to decide whether they want to be conservative, liberal, moderate, and stuff like that. It just dawned on me that I don't want us to be anything, and I certainly don't want us to be moderate. But let me just try it out on those of you who are here. Radically, 100% for openness, or is that like saying nothing? You know, you know what I mean? In other words, for me, it would be 100% as energetic as I could say to get all the conservatives and all the liberals and everyone in between in here for open dialogue, because, you know, in our statement is that truths emerge sort of through the marketplace of ideas. So that's kind of really the niche that, you know, the borders that I sense if we're doing anything, we're just trying to hold that open. And so it doesn't seem like moderate is something that would return for that. So I would love to, does that make any sense to you? Is that like saying nothing? To say we are 100% working every day for openness. You know, so you guys help me with that one. I'd love to think with you.
You know, for some of us who have, as Ryan said, we're old timers, and we've been coming to Sunstone for a lot of years, and I have to say that those early years of Sunstone were much more like that, Dan.
Yeah.
They were much more, the radical fringes would come, and it was much more a dialogue between those groups and those of us who, for one reason or another, I mean, there were so many different ones. I mean, there were a lot of faithful LDS people, excommunicated, those who didn't want to stay in the church but still consider themselves LDS. But then we had a strong fundamentalist camp. We had people who were anti-Mormons who would come. We had, it was a crazy place to be. If those of us, if you remember those early Sunstone symposiums, they were a lot of fun because they were crazy. And I'm not suggesting that we can go back. I just came from the Angels in America earlier today, and we never can go back home again. But I do think that because things change, because movements or communities or whatever it is that we are evolves and changes over time. I do think, though, that there has been an effort, at least that some perceive, a conscientious effort by Sunstone Board of Directors to moderate the discussion and to cut off those extreme viewpoints. Now, whether that was really happening or not, well, it doesn't even matter. That was the perception. And I think maybe that was the kind of thing that Paul Toscano is referring to, that he doesn't find his place so much because he felt once again, and of course these are people who are incredibly sensitive to voice and issues of voice. Do we have voice at all? And so, of course, if you suggest that they don't have voice, they're going to have something to say about that. But I think it changes. I think it evolves. I think it moves in crazy ways, because when you get people together who are engaging in discussion and engaging in the life of ideas, I don't think you can manage which way it goes. And I don't think you can even predict it. And what it would be interesting to know if there are any ways that you could manage it, predict it, into being a movement or into being a community. But I'm not sure that there are. I think it has its own life and its own sense of what moves itself on forward. And as soon as you try to start managing it, I'm afraid that it would give you trouble. That would be my comment. What other comments have you had? We're almost out of time, so you must hurry up here.
I'll take a second turn, sorry. But this is a compelling idea to me, personally.
Because this is my first time. I've subscribed to Sunstone since the early 80s. But I was church education and was forbidden to be here. Or at least not formally forbidden, but subtly, informally forbidden. Now, I have a story. I was retired earlier than I expected from church education. And I was telling Ryan before we started that when I asked them why, the only substantive answer I got was because you're too intellectual. Well, I'd had troubles before that, and I talked to a colleague who's at the Institute of Religion at the University of Utah, and he asked me this question, and this is responding now to the problem, this movement or community, and Dan, this is really for you. He asked me, do you feel alone a lot? And I said, all the time. And he said, so do I. And I got here, it's the first time I've been able to participate 100% in symposium, and from the get-go, from Wednesday morning, I've belonged.
Thank you so very much. I think that's a great place for us to call it quits on this panel, but let me just say that we appreciate it so much, Ryan, and his comments and his work in this area is definitely provocative and interesting, and we want to encourage you to do more and bring it back to us so that we can, either as a community or a movement, continue discussing these ideas. Thank you once again.
I really feel like I'm not alone anymore.